This is Truth Be Told, a Sheridan Life radio podcast exploring the complex issues affecting Indigenous communities in Canada. I'm your host, Danielle Orr. Jen Harper is the founder of Cheekbone Beauty, Inc., an Indigenous-owned Canadian cosmetics company founded in 2016. Jen is Ojibwe, and her personal journey of reconnecting with her Indigenous familial history and breaking generational patterns and trauma led her to start the company. The driving force of Cheekbone Beauty was her dream to create a space in the industry in which Indigenous youth felt represented and inspired. Jen has appeared on Dragon's Den and has been featured in media outlets such as Flare.com, APTN News, and CBC Radio's Unreserved. She won the Social Enterprise Award at the 17th Annual Women in Business Awards and is an avid public speaker. Jen says it's been important to her to educate people on the residential school system throughout growing her business. She also makes sure to give back to the community by donating 10% of the profits of her business to Shannon's Dream, which addresses the educational funding gap for Indigenous youth. I won't say much more about Jen's story because we cover much of it in our interview. Take a listen.
I was just like, thanks
for having me. Oh, no worries. So what is your background? And can you tell our listeners what the difference is between the term Ojibwe and Anishinaabe?
Ooh, that's a good question. Let's hope I explain it correctly because I don't consider myself, I think, an expert in, I think, traditional Indigenous culture because I'm learning. I'm a student learning as much as I can about who I am and where I came from. So Ojibwe is the tribe, and Anishinaabe is the group of people. I don't even think I'm explaining it correctly because I know Anishinaabe Mohan then is the language that this group of people speak that all come from this area, which is like kind of around the Great Lakes, into the U.S. and into Canada. So I know Ojibwe would be one of the tribes. The Algonquin people are one of the tribes, the Odawa people. So it's a few tribes that all are considered Anishinaabe people, and they all speak the same language. But, of course, there's different slang and dialects from each community. So that would be one of the different. So I'm probably not even explaining it properly. But
No. It sounds like Anishinaabe is kind of an umbrella identifier for many other subgroups or tribes.
Yes.
And so do you...
you said it better than I did.
And do you, when you introduce yourself as a Canadian woman or a Ojibwe Canadian woman, is it using Ojibwe or is it using the term Anishinaabe or are they interchangeable for you?
They're completely interchangeable for me because I think I feel like I understand the word Anishinaabe because of the language. I don't know. It's really strange. When I started learning the language, it helped me understand a little bit more of the words and what they mean. But I do say I'm an Ojibwe Canadian woman most times because my dad is Ojibwe and my mom is Canadian. So there's two sides of me split right down the middle.
Okay, awesome. And so you grew up not knowing your Indigenous family initially. How did you reconnect with them?
Yeah, so I grew up knowing, like I knew my mom and dad were together until I was about 2 years old. They had separated. We had all moved from the Thunder Bay area where I was born to Toronto. And my parents then split when we were in Toronto. So my mom and I were on our own. But I did know my dad and have a relationship with him when I was a child till I was about 14. So I think when I was about five, we moved to the Niagara region where I still live today. But my mom and I had left there because she came to this area for a job. And then I would visit my father on the weekends, going to Toronto back and forth on the bus ever since I was little. And him and I did have a good relationship in my early days until I was about 14 when he moved back to our family's home reservation, which is in northwestern Ontario. So that kind of put the distance, really kind of put some barriers, I think, like literally physical because of the distance. And then in terms of the kind of relationship, I guess you could have over the phone with a parent and not being able to visit him very often because it was quite a distance. So we kind of just grew apart. And when I was in my, I think, 19, early 20s, I had visited him, and or he had come to visit me in Toronto, and we just had like a falling out. It was a bad experience, and I just told him I really didn't want a relationship with him any longer, which now as an adult, looking back, I realized that wasn't a mistake. You should try to, I would encourage people to, I think severing a relationship was really damaging for me personally. So that's my personal experience on it. But so I do have, you know, a lot of regrets in just walking away from him. And then while I was healing, so there's 20 something years that I didn't have a relationship with him. And finally, when I was 40, I reached out again as I got sober. Part of my story is recovery. So when I was 38, I actually got sober, and I had made it a plan on my in my 40th year that I was going to reconnect with him and make amends, and we did. And, you know, it's interesting. It's these ideas we have in our heads about what family is and what it should look like and what it should be. But unfortunately, that isn't the case for every human being on the planet. And, you know, I went into, even with both of my parents, mother and father, this expectation of this relationship that didn't exist. And based on, you know, I literally think now I'm like, I was like basing things on like this Hollywood version of family and what it should be like, because those are what you see, and, you know, different friends and seeing, okay, why is my family not like this? But anyway, realizing people can only be what they can be. And sometimes we can't put these incredible expectations on people that aren't capable of doing things that I think we think they should, but they necessarily they can't, because they don't have that capability. So anyway, just loving people for who they are is now what I've learned as an adult that is really important. So I'm really grateful that I do have a relationship with my dad now.
That's really,
and that in turn actually helps me have a relationship with my extended family, and so aunts and uncles and people that I had really regret missing my entire, that's like 20 something years is a long time to not be connected to half of who you are. So having zero connection whatsoever to my Indigenous world. I really look and see now that it was part of the problem.
I love the insight that you gained from your experiences with your dad. I think, sometimes you have to have an acceptance at some point that people can only meet you where they've met themselves, right? Internally.
Yeah, I love the way you said that.
So what was the experience like to learn about your Indigenous family history and culture then? I'm assuming, so your dad is Indigenous and your mom is not? Is that
correct?
Okay.
Yeah, so my dad is Ojibwe from Northwestern Ontario, and you know, learning about it has been mind-blowing. It's been, I love to describe it as, it's like been like heartwarming at the same time as extremely painful. So it's this crazy intersection where I found myself at 38, and then it was 2015 when I started to read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And just before that had come out in 2015, I read a book called The Inconvenient Indian by Thomas Hill. So that was like my introduction at a glimpse of like some history that I was not aware of. You know, I believed, I think, this Hollywood version of Native Canadians or Americans that the rest of the world did. We didn't have any of this real history in our history books at school. We weren't learning about all of these, like horrific truths that had happened in the past. And so it was extremely painful to learn about, but then there's a side of, you know, our culture that is just so beautiful. When you learn the meaning of things, like, I remember my first conference going to an Indigenous woman's business conference, and they opened up the meeting, and I've been in the corporate world for 15, 20 years, and I've never gone to a conference where they, they started the morning with a drum. And I'm like, I had no idea why I started to cry. I was like, what is happening? And another woman there, she said, and she's explaining to me the meaning of the drum, and it's our heartbeat, and you know, and this is how they're opening up a conference. And I'm like, this is just the most beautiful thing I've ever been to in my whole life. And so that was the beginning of this newfound relationship that I had in understanding who I was and where I came from. And it's understanding it and looking at things completely differently, because I grew up completely ashamed, ashamed of what I looked like, because there was no hiding the fact that I was an Ojibwe Canadian woman. Like, if I look in the mirror, that's what I see. That's what I've always seen. But unfortunately, because of the stereotypes, the painful stereotypes in some cases that there's truth to them, and then the stereotypes where there is this truth to it, but when you understand why, it helps you see things completely different. And one being alcoholism and abuse and all of these things that I did see in my family and knew were in my family when I was a younger child, and remember and having experiences with my dad and watching his battle with alcoholism. So it was like me completely running away from that. And that's why for that 20-something years, I wanted nothing to do with that. But really, that was, I think, running away from our problems is not the answer. Back then, you know, if I could go back, I would definitely want to face those situations head on and learn more about the why. It's because truly when we get why something happens, it helps us heal. Mm-hmm. It helps us understand. So I couldn't heal. I realize that now without knowing why. And the why was ultimately my grandmother and grandfather both attended residential school. And that has left lasting impacts that have affected my family until this day. And my research and learning all about it was that this great trauma is affected them and then was passed on to my father and his siblings and then passed on to me and my siblings. And it's in our DNA. And until we start to heal, we can't fix our family unless some of us start to heal, and then we can help each other, right? So it's trying to, you know, I'm at the point where I know that if I don't do this, who's going to stop it? And this is in my immediate family, because I know my siblings have a lot of the same struggles as I do. And if we don't fix it and show that there's a different way, then it would continue. And I have kids, like I have no option but to show them that we can, you know, if we can pass on generational trauma, we can pass on generational like success and thriving as well.
In an effort to describe the generational trauma for listeners who might not understand it like in an intimate way, what because you mentioned that it was passed down to you and your siblings along the line of your family from starting with your grandparents with their experience, what exactly would you describe being passed down, other than saying generational trauma, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. So if you ever were to like bake a loaf of bread, right, it just as an example, and there's a dent in that pan, every loaf of bread going forward is going to have that dent in that pan, right? So my grandmother leaves residential school, coming back to our family's reservation, which is set in the most beautiful setting possible in Lake of the Woods in Northern Ontario. She's like surrounded by the boreal forest, but there's no therapy. And how does a young woman possibly even proceed in healing herself without any help? So there's no help. There's no resources. This young woman then goes on to have children and just starts raising a family. And as a mom now, looking back, I can't imagine having as many kids as my grandmother did and trying to keep it all together, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's that in itself, and not, like, just things like not being allowed to love, like being beaten for speaking, like the damage that had done was just, the effects are mind-blowing. So then that trauma, or, you know, she then herself began to be abuse alcohol to deal with pain, right? Mm-hmm. It's a common substance for people that have pain that they're trying to deal with and don't know how to deal with. So she then starts abusing alcohol, and that cycle is continued of passing on this pain and not teaching anyone actually how to deal with that pain. So go back to that bread pan and start massaging it down and putting it back in place, right? Like it's aluminum, so you can work it back. You can work it back to its original shape, right? There might be still a few little indentations, but it's not going to be maybe as dramatic as a giant dent in that pan. So, I mean, I know my own father didn't do, I think, the work to deal with his trauma. And then again, we have that same situation being passed on to me and my siblings. And then that coping mechanism of using a substance to deal with pain is that had been passed on as well.
Right. I mean, if you see that your whole life, and then, yeah, you know, how would you learn otherwise what a proper mechanism is to deal with pain, right? If not from your parents, right?
Yeah. Mm. And so I used to wonder too, because I lived mostly with my mother. I only saw my father on weekends, and then for a long time I didn't. So I'm like, I was angry because how do I become an alcoholic after I fought to avoid those people, right? Like, that's what I thought. I was in this major state of shame. So I'm running away from them because I do not want to be like that. But guess what? Turns out I have severe alcoholism just as much as everyone else did. And it's, you know, I read this book on my healing journey starting in 2014 into 2015, called The Power of Habit. So when I learned about, like, I think this, like the neurology portion of it, the scientific basis of that, we create these neural pathways in our brain on dealing and coping with life and stress, and those, you know, as early childhood memories that I have had on alcohol. I remember being so young, and we were like 10, me and one of my best girlfriends, and her dad used to make like homemade beer, and we stole one. And I remember her and I sharing it. And I was like, oh my goodness, I love the way this makes me feel. Mm-hmm. And looking back over my life now, it was like, that was where I had learned, and my brain created that neuro pathway, or that, like, literally I relate it to like a path in a forest when I'm sharing this with Indigenous youth. Like, it's wearing it down over the years. So even that young age, and then through my teens, because I was like, oh, I was super funny and she was laughing at me, and I was not shy anymore because I was normally such a shy kid. But if I had alcohol, then I became funnier and people liked me. And so that just perpetuated right until it got into this horrible, disastrous disease and sickness that I had to deal with. But that's the road that went down. And I can see how the trauma can play a big role in that, because our brains, you know, that's genetically, it's coming from the same family members that I had that used the alcohol in the same way that I did to make themselves feel better.
Mm-hmm. And if there hadn't been generational trauma for your father, you might not have tried to cope with that by removing yourself from that relationship. And then there's pain against that experience as well that you're trying to deal with in yourself.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's that whole, I realize that in itself just created more of an issue, because, you know, you're missing an important part of your life, of who you are. And then again, then abusing a substance not to deal with those things became a habit, a really bad one.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to transition into talking about your company, Cheekbone Beauty. So how did Cheekbone Beauty start?
So literally, I always say it all relates. It's all intertwined. So I get sober in 2014, November. And in 2015, I literally, like, have this dream, middle of the night, pop out of bed. And, like, in this dream, there was these Native little girls. They were covered in lip gloss. And I just grabbed my laptop, and I was like, okay, I'm going to make lip gloss. And then I wanted to start this scholarship or foundation in my grandmother's name, who was the residential school survivor, Emily Paul. And that was, like, the beginning of what, I guess, Cheekbone is today. And that night was literally me starting to write this thing called a business plan. But fast forward through all of that year of 2015, where I'm reading and doing all this research on business and entrepreneurship, as well as my culture and historically researching what had happened with Indigenous people in Canada and the United States. It was just this eye-opening experience of, I couldn't believe, as an Indigenous woman, how did I not know any of this? Like, I was almost, I'm still embarrassed sometimes when I say that, like, I knew nothing about really what happened to me, to my family. And then I was like, okay, well, now I know something, now I have to do something. And what could I do? I had no experience in anything to do with my culture, but I had been in a sales and marketing role for the last 10 years. And I knew if I could create a brand, and figure out how to sell a product, then I could talk about that while trying to create this scholarship fund with a portion of the profits. So that's literally what we had done. I always say I used like lipstick as this platform, and a platform where, as we said earlier in our conversation, where I want to change this story. I want this new narrative for Indigenous people. I want people to see how resilient we are. And not that I want people to see that. Sorry, I should be really clear. This is for Indigenous youth. Like, these kids deserve and to understand, one, their enormous value in the world, and see their faces in a beauty brand that hasn't existed up until this point. Nobody in the beauty industry has been paying attention to Indigenous people. And I need them to see how resilient our DNA is, this like horrible things that have happened historically, but we're still here. And that in itself is so powerful to realize. And I think it's so important in this day and age, especially when the amount and the enormous suicide rates that our communities face, that these kids grow up needing to understand and see how resilient and powerful they really are. And that is so close to my heart, because while building Cheekbone after my getting well, in 2016, I lost my own brother to suicide. And it was the most painful situation I think I've ever felt in my entire life. I can't remember anything worse. And I knew from that moment on, I'm like, this has to be huge. This has to be so that every Indigenous kid around the world, not just Canada and the United States, around the world, because every Indigenous community has been affected by colonization in some shape or form, and it's usually affected negatively, not positively. Mm-hmm. How do these kids know their value? And we're going to make sure that they see it.
Wow. That's incredible, Jen. Why does representation matter in the beauty industry, especially pertaining to Indigenous youth?
I think, you know, it's such a hard question, because I personally don't think I understood how important it was until I started doing this work. Mm. And then I started relating it to, you know, everything I'm doing, this is really just relating to my own childhood. And never seeing your face or people like you, or that came from the places that you do, or grew up with the same way you did, or ate the same kind of traditional food that you ate, or did the same things as you, it's hard to see yourself ever in any kind of positions in any industry if you can't see yourself had being there or doing that. And that means just showing faces of people that have been there and done that. And I realize that that is just so important for our kids to see that. So so that they can see that they can do it, that it's literally, you know, the big, on our big sort of goal that we keep on our vision board here at the office is that every Indigenous kid around the world will be able to see Cheekbone on a shelf in a beauty, whether store, wherever, and say, our people did that, I can do that. And that's kind of like the whole, like the thread from, and the reason why we're doing everything that we do is for them to feel that and see that. So no matter what they do, so beauty, regardless, doesn't matter the industry. And that's why we started this collection, which we've become really well known for called the Warrior Woman Collection. So it's a collection of liquid lipsticks that are super pigmented and highly powerful in terms of their color and lasting power. But we name them all after Indigenous women from so many different communities across North America that are doing amazing things in their own industry and in their own way. And that was because, again, I was like, okay, here's more of like a path that I want them to see that exists for them, in whether it be Cindy Blackstock, who's the executive director of the First Nation Child and Family Caring Society, where we give 10% of our donations for Shannon's Dream. Cindy's been in the social work realm for, I don't want to guess, I know it's well over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then not only in that area, but then she's been fighting for the rights of First Nations kids for that long. And that's her job and her role. And then we have other women like Ashley Cullingbow, who's, you know, was the first First Nations woman to win the Mrs. Universe pageant. And then, of course, like Buffy St. Marie, and there's like the list goes on. And Melina, who's like an environmental activist. And then we have Pam, who's a lawyer. And then we have, I'm trying to think of the name of Tanya, who's an Inuk throat singer. And we have 16 in total, and I'm like missing people, missing them right now. But just the point is, it's just for our youth to see, well, look at this beautiful woman, and she did this thing. So I can see myself going off and doing that because somebody has blazed the trail before me.
Wow, I love that the names of your products are meaningful and not just kind of a marketing thing, right? It's really meaningful, and it serves a purpose in your mission too.
We purposefully do not want a number on anything. We have to do it for traceability, but we do it so only we can see it, because I'm like, there's no numbers on anything that we do. I'm trying to, because I think you know, it's in my culture, I've discovered how there's meaning behind everything, and I love layering that into everything that we're trying to create and make.
Did Cheekbone Beauty, the name, is there a significance to the name, why you chose that?
Yeah, there's a couple reasons. One was, I love cheekbones on any human being. They're like one of my favorite features. Then the second portion was, I remember listening to a podcast with Sarah Blakely, who's the founder of Spanx. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about naming Spanx. And in her search for a name for her business, she like discovered that the K sound helps people remember the word better. I was like, okay. I just remember thinking, ever since I had heard that podcast, I was like, I need a word with a K. So there was that. And then more research in terms of like, when we were thinking of how to market ourselves, I came across information that said people with high cheekbones are perceived as more trustworthy. So I really appreciated that. And then, of course, many, many Indigenous people are known for having these beautiful high cheekbones. Mm. So I'm like, okay, this works. And it is kind of just a fun word. When I look at it now, I'm like, I really do like that word.
Yeah, no, it's a great name. I was just so curious about the origin of that.
Yeah, and we've like trademarked it with our logo, which has been easy in Canada. The U.S. been a little bit more challenging, but we're working on it. we have all the paperwork complete. Now we just have to wait for their approvals, which our lawyer, patent and trademark lawyers, are like, we don't know if this is going to be as easy as it was here.
Well, I hope it works out.
Yeah, I know, me too.
So what is the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society? I think you recently just mentioned it there. I know you guys support it. Why did you choose to support this instead of other organizations?
Yeah, so that was like, it was a big challenge because I used what is called like a business advisory board for the first year of planning. And they were like, I was on this mission to like start this foundation at the same time as starting the business. And this board, which is kind of like a board of directors, like for any company, and they're just sort of non, like unbiased. They have no emotional attachment to you or your business. So they're just super honest, right? And they're like, you cannot start a foundation and a company at the same time. Like it's just as much work. So why don't you focus on building this brand of cosmetics and working on this company and products and find an organization that you can support with donations. And I left and I got home that night and I was so distraught because I'm like, who do you trust, right? Like, you hear so many bad things about organizations that take people's money. And I was struggling with that. And mm-hmm. I then wrote it, you know, I write a lot of things down on a little pad by my bed a lot when I need to find an answer to something. And wrote it. And the next day, I just, like, my first Google search, I found Cindy Blackstock and then had remembered. I saw her on the news like a month prior when she had won the through the Human Rights Commission, the tribunal court case, saying that yes, Canada does treat First Nations children unfairly. And then I started doing research on her and ended up meeting her a couple times. And she is like an incredible human being. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't be happier. I think everything that they do and the organization does is amazing. And specifically having that alignment with their arm or branch of the organization called Shannon's Dream, because we were really passionate about scholarships. One, because I think education is so, so important. And I'm not talking just maybe like even secular. I think education is a fascinating thing, as amazing and as important secular education is, but education on a daily basis, just in empowering yourself with information and learning something new, I think is such a message that I really want Indigenous youth to absorb and understand, that when you do educate yourself in whichever way you choose to, it really will help you move forward and create this beautiful, successful life that you want to create when you have that in your belt, so to speak. And so that was a big part of it. And Shannon's Dream was about this discrepancy in terms of an education funding gap between schools on reservations versus schools off reservation. So when I found out about this organization, I'm learning about Shannon's Dream all at the same time. And it was mind-blowing to me that kids that go to school on reservations are getting 30 to 50% less funding than kids, than my kids right here in the Niagara region, or any kids in any school board region, and that isn't on reserve. And it blew me away. And I'm like, this is just for no reason. It's just not fair. So I was so grateful that they had that. And learning about the young lady that Shannon Kostachewin, who actually started it, her journey to get there, and sadly her passing away was so tragic. But this little girl and everything that she was doing, because she just wanted a safe, comfortable school for her and her friends to learn. And I thought about the whole time, I'm like, all kids need is like a place to learn where they feel like they're happy to go. And like, what are we doing if we're not creating these spaces and foster this love for learning, right? So how are Indigenous kids supposed to ever get to that place where they feel empowered by education if we're not even putting them in a proper school? And we're talking, a lot of these schools on reservation are dilapidated, mold, rodents, like lack of computers, no extracurricular activities. It's not a pleasant place to be. And this young lady, Shannon, was really fighting for First Nations kids and Métis and Inuit kids to have the same schools as the rest of Canadian children. And I couldn't be happier that we give them donations.
For some listeners, that type of situation, not having extracurriculars, not having a safe place to go to school, you know, that's unimaginable, right? Mm-hmm. You may not know this. I'm just curious if you do. Why is there a funding gap for Indigenous youth or on reserve?
So it's literally a battle between the provincial and the federal government, and they argue constantly with nothing getting done of who's going to pay the bill. It's ridiculous. It's really insane, really. Yeah. And so what Cindy organization is obviously does the work, I think, in Ottawa to get heard and try to, like, somebody just pay the bill and make sure that they're getting the same amount of money, right?
Right. You've appeared on Dragon's Den. And you didn't choose to go with a deal offered on the show so as not to give up any equity. Why was that an important decision for you, and how far has your brand come since then?
Well, it was an amazing experience. No deal, regardless of having no deal. But it really pushed me out of my comfort zone. I had never really pitched professionally my business before, so that was awesome. And then getting as nerve-wracking as it was, I left. You feel exhilarated when you do something like crazy like that you would never dream of doing. So that in itself was like exciting. And then standing in front of these are six Canadian business icons. I'm like, if I'm going to have this amount of time and I'm going to ask them questions and I'm going to listen to what they're saying, because as an entrepreneur, you don't get that very often. So I'm going to take full advantage of the situation and just enjoy it. And it was a really enjoyable experience. The CBC is incredible. Their producers are amazing. And the judges are really great, genuine people. Mm-hmm. You have to remember it's a show and made for entertainment purposes, right?
Right, yeah.
So I wouldn't have taken that deal. It's so early in my business, like give up 50%. And my mm-hmm. mission of continuing to empower Indigenous kids would have definitely got lost yeah. if I would have given up something like 50% to one of those dragons. Yeah. But that's a stressful place to be in. You know, you're an entrepreneur and you need capital to scale, to grow, to make this new line of sustainable lipsticks we're making. I wouldn't be able to do it without having funding. So I could see how sometimes people can get really desperate when you really have this dream, and an entrepreneur is generally like a visionary kind of person. So they're like, they want to get to this place that maybe other people can't see yet. And I can see people getting desperate and taking deals that don't feel right, even at the yeah. time. So it's really important, I think, to always have this like set of, I always say, having a set of values and principles that you make all your decisions on based on for your business. And for everybody's business, it's going to be different. But if you have that, then you won't waver in things, right?
Mm-hmm. That's all the questions I have for you. And I just want to say it was a pleasure speaking with you. And I think it's incredible, not only your business and what you're doing and what it represents, but also in your personal journey, cutting the generational trauma pattern in your own life. I think that's really beautiful.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me. I always, people ask advice now to give to fellow entrepreneurs. And, you know, one thing or a piece of advice that I was given that I really think is really, really important. It was someone that said you should always be working harder on yourself than you would do on your business. And so that's like, we're living in this world about self-care right now, right? And how important that is, because we're useless
yeah.
unless we do take care of ourselves. So I would implore all of your listeners to just think about that on some days, because we can go and do these amazing, great things in the world, but we got to make sure that we're healing ourselves first.
That's so true. Great advice.
Thank you for listening to Truth Be Told podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Orr.